Welcome to the Start to Blockchain podcast. I'm Stefan Collins, CMO at Venly, and today we are diving into one of the hottest topics in blockchain, regulation and its impact on adoption in Europe. Joining me is Erwin Volleder, head of policy at the European Blockchain Association. He's been deeply involved in shaping conversations around blockchain regulation, participating in policy discussions on MiCA and CBDCs and digital identity frameworks. With experience at European Central Bank and European Commission, he understands how businesses and regulators navigate compliance in this evolving space. We will break down what companies need to know, clear up misconceptions about regulation, and explore the future of blockchain policy in Europe. Without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, Erwin. Thank you for joining us for our third episode of the Start to Blockchain podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's dive into it. Like, are businesses staying away from blockchain because of the European regulation?
I mean, it depends who you ask. I think we did a lot of work as a continent. I mean, regulators obviously did a lot of work over the last policy cycle to bring some clarity to the industry in regards to what services are and are not on offer here. And I think that broadly speaking, MiCA has been well received. At least I'm speaking of the markets in crypto assets regulation, that it's been well received. There's institutional interest increasingly as well along these lines. But I think if you're talking about just crypto asset service providers, we have a lot of really large, globally significant companies that are setting up in Europe, that have already set up in Europe, and that are looking to expand their presence. So if anything, I see MiCA in the short to medium term as an enabling regulation to bring businesses here. Is it perfect? No. Is any regulation perfect? Obviously not. So I think that there's definitely things that can be ironed out, and maybe we can get into that later on. But as a base, I would say that, at least from my experience, companies aren't shying away from Europe. Yes, reporting requirements are strict in some cases, and compliance requirements and compliance costs may tick to the higher side. But the trade-off, obviously, at least has always been in Europe, this idea of balancing innovation with consumer protection. And so sometimes one wins out over the other. But broadly, I think we're still well-positioned as a continent going forward.
Okay, cool. And like with you, with the European Blockchain Association, you help shape blockchain policy in Europe. So how do you then actually collaborate with regulators and businesses to guide adoption? Because of course you want to help here. How do you do this? How do you even start about talking about compliance and regulation in this blockchain industry?
Well, we have two, at least I would say we have dual functions. So we function on the one hand as an industry, as a trade body, and on the other hand, increasingly as a think tank, is a thought leader in the space. And so we publish our own research as well on different topics, on decentralized finance, on staking, on identity, on custody. And at the same time, from the trade association side, we engage with regulators bilaterally in fora, through webinars, through workshops, through public events, obviously. And we make sure that the voices of our members, but broadly speaking in the industry, are heard. And one thing we don't shy away from is collaborating with other associations, other groups in the industry, companies that may not be part of our direct network, so not within the EBA itself, but looking at other associations in the space, because really this industry started as a grassroots movement. Okay, it's very bottom up rather than top down. We believe in collaboration. We believe in a decentralized approach, and we try to actually live by that principle when we do our outreach and try to preach about good regulation and sensible approaches to balancing innovation and consumer protections.
Yeah, sometimes like crypto and regulation doesn't go hand in hand by each other, but we also believe that regulation is quite important if we want to make the technology also mature and bring in the bigger enterprises and companies. And we know there's still a lot of confusion around blockchain regulation. What's in your opinion the biggest misconception here? Like, if businesses try to navigate compliance, what's the biggest misconceptions you see?
I mean, like, if you're a crypto asset service provider doing business in Europe, then, you know, you're going to have regulations under MiCA, you're going to have operational resilience under DORA, you're going to have AML regulation, you're going to have transfer of funds. So there's layers to the reporting and the due diligence you're going to have to do to ensure that you are following the letter of the law. And I think that this can be daunting, given that the issue with Europe is that Europe does not have a common language. Europe has 27 member states, so there's no lingua franca. So the lingua franca by default becomes the regulatory frameworks that kind of keep everything together. So this can be daunting. I think that clarity around what is not in scope is increasingly becoming more likely on the horizon. I don't have a crystal ball to tell you exactly, okay, like NFTs, DeFi, staking, these things are going to come now. We are waiting at least from the commission for an upcoming report that should touch on some of these issues. But there still are things like DAOs, for example, as well, that are broadly out of scope of the crypto asset regulatory framework, the digital asset framework. And there's reason for that, right? Because some of those areas still may not be mature enough. It may not demand that sort of approach. So to kind of let that innovation still develop in a holistic way is important. But I think that the more and more we get institutions, and this is to your earlier point, interested in the space and wanting to put actual capital and enterprises to put their capital down and invest, then these other things are going to have to become more clear, especially because we see in other jurisdictions, for example, where some of these questions are already starting to be answered. And so I will say, though, that it takes a lot to pass laws in Europe, like MiCA. If you look at the start to finish, we're 5 years in. Long time, right? So there's a bit of regulatory fatigue as well, I would say. And maybe now isn't the best time to start putting down a whole new suite of laws, because the industry still needs time to digest kind of what was done already and to see how this works, right? Because empirically, when a regulation is passed, companies start applying, they get licenses, etc. And then sooner or later, you see kinks appear, you know, this is difficult to comply with, or we're having troubles here, difficulty. And this is the feedback that obviously the public sector needs in order to see, okay, when things come for review, what do we review, right? So I would say that, speaking personally, I hope we don't see any new digital asset regulation this cycle from the commission and from the parliament and council. I think we are our hands are more than full with MiCA and with what we have already in DORA and AML package and everything else. So I think it's time to just see how this develops and see how companies are balancing this and dealing with it.
Interesting. Like, and for to make it more like practical, like for listeners, because they are not MiCA specialists or compliance or regulations specialists. Imagine I'm a European-based company and I would like to start using blockchain. And for my use case, I also need fiat on an off-ramps in my project. What challenges do I need to overcome? Because this is a question you have the theoretical part, the framework, and then you have the practical part. Mm-hmm. I want to run a company in Europe. I need fiat on an off-ramps. What challenges do I have to overcome as a company?
Well, the thing is, are you the company issuing the e-money? Because if you are, then you're not going to get safeguarding accounts with the central bank. Credit institutions that you partner with are going to have to do that. You have fintechs and neobanks that you can partner with for on and off ramping, right? This is clearly possible, but you're going to have to make sure that you've identified your parties. So transfer of funds is going to apply depending on the type of service. PSD2, so Payment Services Directive, might apply, right? Which means you need to basically know every single transaction and who's behind it, etc. So it does depend on like how you want to apply that specifically. You may not end up being a CASP. You may end up being a PSP if you're just dealing with e-money for the purposes of payments, right? But if you're dealing with crypto assets as well, then you may be a CASP falling under MiCA. And then, you know, there's what about custody? What about this? So these are questions that whenever businesses are looking to navigate in Europe, it's really important to understand, first of all, like which jurisdictions have which competitive advantage. Because typically in a European case, like if you look before crypto and digital assets, etc., like for example, Luxembourg was always really strong on funds, right? UCITS, AIF, etc. Germany, France, you know, a lot of MiFID licenses. And so we see these sort of things repeating themselves with crypto assets as well, right? So it's important if you're a third country service provider looking to get licensed in the EU, set up an operation here, to also look at the, I wouldn't say forum shopping, but what sort of companies and what sort of CASPs are concentrated in the jurisdiction you're looking to apply in, you know, because one national competent authority may be leaning one way versus the other in terms of what they're comfortable granting licenses for and for who, right? But generally speaking, I think that especially over the last 5 years, there's been a lot of internal development that's happened from the NCAs. Like, I can tell you that the French in my own dealings are exceptionally qualified. Like, the regulators in France really know their stuff. And I think that's really, really positive. They actually take the time to learn. They put out a lot of public consultations. They currently have one, the AMF and ACPR. So the ACPR is through the Bank of France, and then the AMF is the capital markets, right? On certifying smart contracts. Okay, they did a DeFi consultation as well, which we replied to as an industry body along with some other key players. So they've really put in a lot of effort. BaFin as well, Luxembourg, obviously the Spanish, the Portuguese, Slovenia. So a lot of jurisdictions in Europe are doing their best to upskill their own internal workforce and hire as well, because obviously this is new territory. And
yeah, true.
You can't expect that, you know, somebody who's been there for 20 years is now suddenly going to become a crypto asset expert. So it's really important, obviously, as well, for that reason, because if you mentioned you're on and off ramping, you come to a regulator with a business model. This business model is extremely detailed. You outline everything. It's really important that they also know how to digest your business model to be able to funnel that into which regulatory pathway may or may not apply. And I think that this is something that's going to be an iterative process, especially when we look at DeFi and stuff, because DeFi staking, these things are super complicated, technically speaking, and they move like this, right? So, you know, when we're talking about DeFi back in, you know, I remember like 2018, 2019, it's not the DeFi we're talking about now.
No.
It's not going to be the DeFi we talk about in 2030. Because innovation just moves much faster than people, than governments, than laws, and that's normal. Okay, so it's just a matter of also this catch up effect that needs to take place.
And is this what you then actually do with European Blockchain Association? Also guide these companies in the regulation framework, helping them to understand what the regulation is, what they can do, and then of course you also talk to regulators themselves. Is this then your position?
So our members, obviously, when they have questions, they come to us. Our members also have their own legal counsel. But as an association, we're also there to provide clarity in whichever way we can. And then on these more forward-looking issues, we tend to write policy papers on this regard. And we try to imagine those outcomes and what the potential regulatory pathways, the causality of those pathways might be under a European framework, right? And so this is extremely important when you're looking at things like liquid staking, like DAOs, for example, like digital identity, verifiable credentials, on and off chain identifiers, these sort of things. Our head of growth, he's an exceptionally talented product specialist. So he actually publishes a lot in the Ethereum community as well. He has his own blog, Eugenio, a little shameless plug. But I think this speaks to the depth of the technical knowledge that we have at the association as well. So, you know, and he's off looking at things like chain abstraction and modularity and Merkleized credentials and all these things. So we really try to paint a wide brush, which is important, though, because sooner or later, those questions, those developments in the product space are going to find their way to the table of some regulator and onto their screen. And they're going to be looking at this and then trying to make sense of it. And so I think it's important to also remember that none of this is happening in a vacuum.
An interesting question, I guess, is like many enterprises also struggle with the choice between private and public blockchain, because you have a regulatory framework, mm-hmm. you have a lot of public blockchains, but there's also something like private blockchains. Mm-hmm. From a policy or regulation standpoint, are there like key factors that you should consider or tips and tricks you can give? Or is the private blockchain space something different from a regulation point of view than the public one?
It's more so from a utility point of view. And generally speaking, personally, I'm obviously a fan of public blockchains more than a fan of private blockchains, of interoperability, of modularity. And I really think that it's going to be very difficult if you're building in a silo to be able to optimize, right, consensus, governance, and execution layers the way you will in the future with public permissionless blockchains. I think that it does depend on the use case. So, for example, if you look at some of the larger banks and the financial institutions, so JP Morgan has Kinexys, then Goldman has GSDAP, then there's Orion, etc. All these platforms are closed loop. They serve a specific purpose. whether it's collateral management, fund administration, intraday repo, et cetera. And it makes sense for the bank and its partners, okay? And its clients, its customers, its business partners, the companies that it does business with, et cetera. Start to talk about bridging, for example, Orion with GSDAP. That's not a discussion yet, okay? And I think a lot of what's happening in the public permissionless space is also moving towards using these opportunities for modularity and composability to bring the institutions in. And I think that this is going to be key also for their development in the future, because a lot, especially on the financial institution side, were really pro permissionless blockchains. But 5-6 years ago, a lot of them are now changing their tune because they've realized that building a walled garden is very difficult for customer acquisition, partnership origination, and things like that. And so what we face still, unfortunately, is so fragmentation on the one hand, but as L2s develop more, we're going to get hopefully cheaper transaction costs. So Ethereum's rollup strategy, for example, projects building on Optimism, Superchain, et cetera, like that, Avalanche subnets and stuff. These things, I think, are going to be really key for bringing a lot of enterprise adoption into the space. And for example, Polygon is a great example of this as well, because they're one of the best, in my opinion, one of the best enterprise level blockchain platforms out there. And they had Polygon ID, which is now Privado ID, which is doing its own thing in terms of taking the IDEN 3 ZK layer and then kind of building from that open source concept. So I really think that there's, from a product perspective, once you go open source, you never go back.
Yeah.
Like it's I don't know of any instances where companies have gone to an open source framework and then decided, no, we're just going to package that and go back to what we were doing, because there's so much more network effects, right? And at the end of the day, that's money, right? If you're a company, yeah, you're looking to accelerate your growth strategy, right? So from a regulatory perspective, I think when you look at public permissionless blockchains in DeFi and how they're used around liquidity pools and stuff like that, like this is still obviously a problem for institutions that want to play in that space, because if you have a pool of liquidity and it's pseudonymous, who, like if I've spun up a MetaMask and you have, and we've committed as LPs to this pool, there's no KYC that was done. If you're a bank and you want to play in that, you obviously can't. And so permissioned hooks are going to become, I think, a really big trend to bring institutional interest into DeFi, at least, right? Where you can build the permissioned layer on top of a permissionless applications. The hooks that are necessary for compliance into that, I think, is going to be really interesting. Base is already doing that as well, right? They have the ability for that KYC composability into Base, and they've brought 500 million on chain in the last while. So, you know, this to me is the ultimate trade-off for obliged entities in a space, is, you know, counterparty identification, so counterparty risk, operational risk, and then the cyber resilience risk, right? Like the smart contracts being secure, being audited, robust, not hack prone as best you can. So like white hat tested, pen tested, these sort of things. And there's ways to do this from a grassroots level, right? Like through bounty programs and other ways to incentivize people to audit smart contracts. And I think that this is potentially something we may see make its way into a regulatory framework, because a lot more I'm seeing regulators understand that product liability standards may apply more than financial regulation to smart contracts, which I think is a better focus. If you focus on the robustness of the architecture and making sure that it's audited and secure rather than trying to financialize everything, then some regulatory aspects that we borrow from the product space, from just building things, make sense, because at the end of the day, a smart contract is something that you code it, but it is built de facto. So these are, in my opinion, positive developments. And so to answer your question in the long way, it depends. Really depends on what use case you're building. But I think that in the long run, ultimately the utility in public permissionless networks is there. And then that's before we even get into things like the agentic web or DeepIn or things like that, right? Which is really where that scalability will take off.
Yeah, I still think that like these bigger enterprises, institutions choosing for private blockchain is more because blockchain is in and see like very transparent. Everything is readable on chain. And I think it's also a bit because of that they say, yeah, it's financial information, it's critical. information that we don't want to put outside for everyone that they maybe now choose for the private chain. But of course, yeah, it's not because you're on chain that privacy is not important. So I think this is a very interesting point of view and the future to understand that, like, it's not because it's public that it's open for everyone and that you can read everyone, that you have access to all this information.
I mean, with rollups, right? And with as ZK scales, as it becomes more cost efficient to use at scale, and then combining it with things like fully homomorphic encryption and these sort of things, I think it's going to be the game changer for combining the privacy with the minimal, so the minimal disclosure with the auditability and with the transaction throughput, ultimately, because you're taking all of that heavy computational stuff, you're bringing it off chain. You can publish the proof rather than everything that you need to. This may be a way also for GDPR compliance in the future and other privacy laws, because ultimately, as you said, you don't want certain bits of information about your customers, for example, or healthcare data or stuff like that to just be public. And in some cases, for example, a public permissioned network may make more sense, like with healthcare data. So if there's like 4 or 5 hospitals that are sharing double blind clinical trial data between them, and they have to keep everything else private rather than just showing like the side of the data that basically shows how an individual may have tested or not, then a public permissioned network where you can set those gates may be the appropriate choice, right? So like a public permissionless framework isn't necessarily for everything, but it sure is for a lot of things. And I think that this, again, that's why it depends. It's a case by case basis on what you're building that enterprise solution for.
Yeah, but it's still interesting to see that the space itself, from an infrastructure and technology point of view, they're aware of the sensitive things, and they are working on, like you say, the ZK login and all these kind of stuff. Yeah. So that's
privacy pools, right? Privacy pools are a great example of doing this from a bottom-up perspective. And I think that's also something that we shouldn't lose sight of, the fact that privacy is a fundamental right for all people. And I think privacy pools and mixers and these sort of things get a bit of a bad rap in some cases. I personally believe there are reasons why somebody would want to use this. For example, dissidents in countries, that's a clear one. So I'm happy to see that some court filings in certain cases that are ongoing may be moving in a more positive direction. I won't say more. But I think that this is the fundamental question of our time. Because look, one thing about blockchain, if you use it wrong, it is the ultimate surveillance tool. It really is. You could build a surveillance capitalism infrastructure that is Orwellian levels of dystopian using DLT and AI in combination, right? You could build a digital prison, literally. And so, but it's a technology. You could also use it to build something that's ultimately super beneficial for humanity. And so far, you know, I'm really happy that what we see in the industry is people trying to build more on the positive side. And that's why it's important to make sure that privacy is something that we don't lose sight of as society digitalizes, blockchain or otherwise. But that's why we have privacy laws that need to be respected. And thankfully, we have super smart developers who are working on ways to have our cake and eat it too.
And more a funny question to ask, like, if you had a magic wand, what would you change in the blockchain industry?
If I had a magic wand, I would go back to 2010 and buy Bitcoin. That's what I would do.
And from a technology point of view, is there's like we are talking a lot about misconception and about privacy as on the private side and it's not on the public side. Is there something from that point of view? Yeah, like I would do the same, like going back, buy a lot of Bitcoin and now wait until today. But from the other side, the more side, enterprise. I mean,
to be honest with you, if I could wave a magic wand and Ethereum's roll-up strategy was just done, that would be really cool to see. Because a lot of other networks are, you know, they're competing for that part of the industry. Like if you've seen the growth of Solana over the last couple of years,
yeah,
it's astronomical, right? And it's unfair to just say that that's due to meme coins. I think that generally, Solana also holds a lot of utility as a network, and so does Avalanche and Optimism and Aptos and all these other guys, right? Like it really does depend again on what you are building for. But I think as an industry, we sometimes get bogged down. Like if somebody's a Bitcoin maxi or an Ethereum maxi or a Solana maxi or whatever, you know, I just want us to all get along because ultimately this should be like building for public good, right? It's the next generation of the internet. It's something that's there for all of us, hopefully. And that's why I'm just rooting for everybody to succeed, because I really think that at the end of the day, that's the important part.
Yeah. When I go to events and talking to maxis and, like you said, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Sol maxis, whatever, I'm always questioning, like, is it because of the technology or is it because you're personally involved in one or specific token, right? So, and this is a bit of discussion that you have, like, you have people in a company that are also personally involved, and that's okay. That's not an issue. But that's why you have this kind of people trolling about, oh, the Solana is because of meme coin. No, there's a lot of technology behind it. The same of Polygon. Polygon is a long time in the space, and now there's no hype running on Polygon at the moment. So, and the crypto side of things, it's like, oh, they are done, but that's not. They are building behind the scene. They are creating a lot of interesting utility and building an infrastructure for the future. And this is interesting to see with all the narratives and the hype up and down that keep on building. Is actually the long-term strategy we should have. And that's an interesting one here.
Look, Ethereum's last upgrade happened. Most people slept through it. Like, unless you were a hardcore developer watching, you slept through it.
But I watched it.
But that's how it should be, though. Like, these things should be predictable and boring and reliable at the end of the day. That's a sign of reliability. I think that, generally speaking, like, the maturity of a network and its ability and its staying power, like you said, it's not about whether or not there's a million meme coins being launched or stuff like that. It's all the hard work, the sweat, and the sweat equity that's being put into it behind the scenes to develop real solutions. And that stuff takes time. It doesn't happen overnight because it's very complicated work. And like I said, smarter people than I are working on these problems. And I'm happy they are. So I'm really excited to see what we see coming out of stealth mode in the next 4 to 5 years, especially now with the way that policy is shaping up in the United States. And there's a huge push for moving the industry. It's going to be very exciting to see what products launch and what iterations we see coming up and how, for example, me being here in Europe, how Europe fits into this broader landscape. Because one thing we haven't discussed is MENA region, and MENA region is going full steam ahead, and they have been. They are producing very comprehensive regulatory frameworks that are innovation friendly. Companies, big companies, are going and setting up their HQs down there. There's products being launched. There's a vibrant developer ecosystem. There's a vibrant venture capital ecosystem. So, you know, we're not the only game in town, so to speak, right? There's different pockets of this happening around the world. Singapore, obviously, you have the Bahamas. You have Gibraltar, you have the UK is trying to get back into things slowly but surely. And I think that this is really where we're going to see a lot of potentially maybe Washington effect. So we have this concept of a Brussels effect. And, you know, as Brussels does, so these normative things kind of get pushed on to other regions of the world. But I really think that with Trump being as bullish as he is, maybe not him so much, but the people around him that he's put in, everybody from Quintens to Atkins to Sachs and Lutnick and Bessent and all those guys, you know, there's a lot to say about, but we may see a Washington effect, right? A lot of push because they have, at the end of the day, the largest companies in the world, a lot of them started in the US. And now they have their voices being heard, right? At home.
Yeah. And tapping into the US thing, like there's a lot of regulatory announcements coming from the US, and the US is now suddenly bullish again because of having a new president. Do you feel that this causes more belief and trust in blockchain also in Europe, or is it just the other way around?
I mean, that's tough to say at this point. I think given how Donald Trump approaches global politics, a lot of European leaders are not too happy with him at the moment. And I think that my fear is that they will see the United States really being like bullish on crypto and on digital assets and associate that to their dislike of the sitting president, and that this may have a negative feedback loop on all the work that's being done here, even though they've spent 5 years putting together an extremely comprehensive regulatory framework. So I'm hopeful that that's not going to be the case. But I'm cognizant of the fact that it's a possibility, given that politics is unpredictable. And at the end of the day, these are all people and people have opinions. people in power have opinions, just like you and I have opinions, right? So I think it's going to be important to see to what extent the developments coming from the US are having an effect on the US competitively. Because Europe is very, very, especially after the report released by Mario Draghi over the summer, the Draghi report, right, to massive volumes, competitiveness is a big issue now. And the Commission's released its competitiveness compass. And one of those 3 points is innovation and supporting innovation. And so to what extent is all of this hype, regulatory hype from the US going to have a net positive impact on their competitiveness in crypto, on how much capital is being invested, products being shipped, frameworks being developed, right, from the public sector? That will ultimately decide or may have a decision-making factor on how we see things in Europe or how that affects things in Europe, right? But for now, he's been president for what, like 6 weeks?
Yeah, something like that.
5 weeks or something. So I think it's still early, but they have been putting out a lot. And what's really interesting to see is that non-euro area central banks, so central banks that don't have the euro, specifically Czechia and Norway, are looking at or have floated the idea of either like spot BTC ETFs, like an allocation either into spot BTC or through strategy, right? Having allocation through strategy. Well, the Norwegian Central Bank floated the idea of putting investment into strategy. And we see a lot of states in the United States that have floated bills for a strategic Bitcoin reserve. And this national digital asset reserve that Trump and his advisors have floated, right? So to have this strategic reserve of like made in USA coins.
Yeah.
Whether or not Bitcoin is going to be a part of this, I think is a super important question, because recently Mubadala, so the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi, disclosed that they have $500 million in spot Bitcoin ETFs. And so this is really, really broadly going to potentially impact monetary policy in the future, right? Like, is Bitcoin going to be a strategic reserve asset? Will central banks put it on balance sheets? Will European central banks put it on balance sheet? I don't know if Euro system central banks will, because that's a hard sell given the ECB stance on Bitcoin. But the ones that don't, it's fair game.
And like a last question, it's about the future. How do you see the blockchain space regulation evolving the upcoming 5 years? Like, do you see trends? And I know it's...
I hope we don't have any more regulation in Europe. I really do. I say this because there's so much with Mika in terms of companies having their hands full navigating this framework.
Understanding, like, even us as a company, we are a Belgian-based company. We took a lot of effort in understanding how the Mika regulation is actually applied or doesn't apply to us because of the infrastructure we are offering to our customers, and customers coming to us and asking, are you regulated? Do we need to be regulated? You're in Europe. We are in Europe. How? So I can imagine that no regulation or a clear framework or a clear window where to walk in can help for the growth in Europe. Otherwise, it's very hard to compete with.
The fear is to over-regulate, right? Like, there's so much already from an AML side, from crypto asset service provider side, from payment side, and the payment services directive is up for a review, right? So we're going to have a PSD3 PSR soon and all this stuff. Digital euro is another thing that's still making its way through the regulatory legislative train schedule, rather. You know, there's a lot. And I think that we don't need right now a Mika 2. We don't need a regulation on staking. We don't need a regulation on any of these other things broadly. These are issues that should come up in the future, yes. But for now, I think we should focus on applying what we have and seeing what works and doesn't. And then when that is up for review, when you reopen the books, you can make changes, propose amendments, and something else. But it still may be a little bit too early to tack on all of that other stuff.
And the last thing, if you could share like one message or tip with the listeners, what would that be? Can be anything, like what comes to your mind?
Find time to read.
About?
Find time to read in your day, on the weekend, whenever you can, find time to read. I know everyone's busy. Everyone does their own thing. And people like yourselves, you're managing a business and employees, and that takes a lot of time and effort, and it's very stressful. But I think that in this industry, you do yourself an extreme disservice if you don't try to stay up to date with what's happening. I know that's very difficult when people get busy. I myself am also very busy. But I try to find time throughout my week where I dedicate to specifically reading and catch up, because, you know, in this space, you miss a week, you miss a year.
Yeah.
Almost. So yeah. Find time.
So fast.
It compounds. Yeah, it compounds little by little, right? It compounds.
And if people want to reach out to you or they want to become member of European Blockchain Association, where can they find you the best?
For the association, they can find us on the website, europeanblockchainassociation.org. We have a contact info link there. They can send a request. Somebody will get back to them. Myself, I'm on LinkedIn. Mostly that's where I'm active. So Erwin Valder, you can follow me, connect on LinkedIn. And yeah, happy to chat.
Yeah. And we will add your LinkedIn profile link to the details of the podcast so people can always reach out. Erwin, thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge about regulation and compliance. And thank you so much. Hope to have
you
in a few years to see where we are, and maybe there's no regulations anymore.
Thanks a lot. Let's see. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Start to Blockchain. If you're exploring blockchain but don't know where to start, the Start to Blockchain Innovator Program gives you expert guidance, platform credits, and a clear path forward. Apply now at venly.io. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast for more insights and stories from industry leaders. I see you the next time.